Lothar must have relapsed into unconsciousness, for he awoke with a start and could not remember where he was or how he had got there. Then the smell of his arm, sick and disgusting, brought it back to him, and he crawled to the edge of the cliff and looked out towards the south. He saw his pursuers then for the first time, and even at the distance of a mile or more, he recognized the two wraith-like little figures that danced ahead of the column of horsemen. "Washman," he whispered. Now he understood how they had come so swiftly. "She has put her tame bushman onto me." He realized then that there had never been any chance of throwing them off the spoor. All that time Lothar had used in covering their sign and in anti-tracking subterfuges had been wasted. The bushman had followed them with barely a check over the worst going and most treacherous tracking terrain. Then he looked beyond the trackers and counted the number of men coming against him. 7, he whispered, and his eyes narrowed as he tried to pick out a smaller feminine figure among them. But they were dismounted, leading their horses, and the intervening Mopani obscured his vision. He transferred all his attention from the approaching horsemen to his own preparations. His only concern now was to delay the pursuit as long as possible, and to convince the pursuers that all of his band were still together, here upon the summit. Every hour he could win for them would give Hendrik and Manny just that much more chance of escape. It was slow and awkward, working with one hand. But he jammed Kleinboy's rifle into a niche of the granite, with the muzzle pointing down towards the plain. He looped a strap from one of the water bottles over the trigger and led the other end to his chosen shooting stance in the shadows, protected by a flare of the granite ledge. He had to pause for a minute to rest, for his vision was starring and breaking up into patches of blackness, and his legs felt too weak to support his weight. He peeped over the edge, and the horsemen were much closer, on the point of emerging from the Mopani forest into the open ground. Now he recognized Santaine, slim and boyish in her riding breeches, and he could even make out the bright yellow speck of the scarf around her throat. Despite the fever heat and the darkness in his head, despite his desperate circumstances, he still found a bittersweet admiration for her. "By God, she never gives up," he muttered. "She'll follow me over the other side to the frontiers of hell." He crawled to the pile of discarded water bottles and, dragging them after him, arranged them in 3 separate piles along the lip of the ledge. And he knotted the leather straps together so that he could agitate all the piles simultaneously with a single twitch of the strap in his hand. "Nothing else I can do," he whispered, "except shoot straight." But his head was throbbing, and his vision danced with the hot mirage of his fever. Thirst was an agony in his throat, and his body was a furnace. He unscrewed the stopper on the water bottle and drank, carefully controlling himself, sipping and holding it in his mouth before swallowing. Immediately he felt better, and his vision firmed. He closed the water bottle and placed it beside him with the spare ammunition clips. Then he folded his jacket into a cushion on the lip of granite in front of him and laid the Mauser on top of it. The pursuers had reached the foot of the kopje and were clustered about his abandoned horse. Lothar held up his good hand in front of his eyes, with the fingers extended. There was no tremor. It was steady as the rock on which he lay, and he cuddled the butt of the Mauser in under his chin. "The horses," he reminded himself. "They can't follow Manny without horses." And he drew a long breath, held it, and shot Blaine Malcolmus's chestnut mare in the centre of the white blaze. As the echoes of the shot still bounced from the cliffs of the surrounding hills, Lothar flicked the bolt of the Mauser and fired again. but this time he jerked the strap attached to the other rifle, and the report of the two shots overlapped. The double report would deceive even an experienced soldier into believing there was more than one man on the summit. Strangely, in this moment of deadly endeavour, the fever had receded. Lothar's vision was bright and clear, the sights of the Mauser starkly outlined against each target, and his gun hand steady and precise, as he swung the rifle from one horse to the next and sent each one crashing to earth with a headshot. Now they were all down except one, Santaine's mount. He picked Santaine up in the field of his gun sight. She was galloping back towards the Mapani, lying flat over her horse's neck, her elbows pumping, a man hanging from her stirrup. And Lothar lifted his forefinger from the curve of the trigger. It was an instinctive reaction. He could not bring himself to send a bullet anywhere near her. Instead, he swung the barrel away from her. The riders of the downed horses, all four of them, were straggling away towards the Mapani, their thin cries of panic carried to the summit. They were easy marks. He could have knocked them down with a single bullet for each, but instead he made it a game to see how close he could come without touching one of them. They ducked and cavorted as the Mauser fire whipped around them. It was comical, hilarious. He was laughing as he worked the bolt, and suddenly he heard the wild, hysterical quality of his laughter ringing hollowly in his own skull, and he bit it off. "I'm losing my head," he thought. "Got to last it out." The last of the running men disappeared into the forest, and he found himself shaking and sweating with reaction. "Got to be ready," he encouraged himself. "Got to think. Can't stop now. Can't let go." He crawled to the second rifle and reloaded it, then rolled back to his shooting stance in the shadow of the summit boulders. "Now they are going to try and mark me," he guessed. "They'll draw fire and watch for..." He saw the helmet being offered invitingly above the lip of the ravine at the edge of the forest, and grinned. That was a hoary old trick. Even the red-necked pommy soldiers had learned not to fall for it, as far back as the opening years of the Boer War. It was almost insulting that they should try to entice him with it now. "All right, then," he taunted them. "We'll see who foxes who." He fired both rifles simultaneously, and a moment later jerked the straps attached to the piles of empty water bottles. At that range, the movement of the round felt-covered bottles would show against the skyline, just like the heads of hidden riflemen. "Now they will send men to circle the hill," he guessed, and watched for movement among the trees on his flanks, the Mauser ready, blinking his eyes rapidly to clear them. 5 hours until dark, he told himself. Hendrik and Manny will be at the river by dawn tomorrow. Got to hold them until then. He saw a flash of movement out on the right flank. Men crouching and running forward in short bursts, outflanking the kopje, and he aimed for the trunks over their heads. Mauser fire whiplashed and bark exploded from the Mapani, leaving wet white wounds on the standing timber. "Keep your heads down, mein Herren!" Lothar was laughing again, hysterical, delirious cackles. He forced himself to stop it, and immediately the image of Manny's face appeared before him, the beautiful topaz eyes swimming with tears, and the flash of blood on his upper lip. "My son," he lamented. "Oh God, how will I live without you?" Even then he would not accept that he was dying. But blackness filled his skull, and his head dropped forward onto the filthy, pus-stained bandage that swaddled his arm. The stench of his own decaying flesh became part of the delirious nightmares which continued to torment him, even in unconsciousness. He came back to reality gradually, and he was aware that the sunlight had mellowed and the terrible heat had passed. There was a tiny breeze fanning the hilltop, and he panted for the cooler air, sucking it gratefully into his lungs. Then he became aware of his thirst, and his hand shook as he reached for the water bottle. It required an enormous effort to remove the stopper and lift it to his lips. One gulp, and the bottle slipped from his grip, and precious water splashed the front of his shirt and glugged from the bottle, pooling on the rock, evaporating almost immediately. He had lost fully a pint before he could retrieve the bottle, and the loss made him want to weep. Carefully, he screwed the stopper closed, then lifted his head and listened. There were men on the hill. He heard the distinct crunch of a steel-shod boot biting into a granite foothold, and he reached for one of the potato-masher grenades. With the Mauser over his shoulder, he crawled back from the edge and used the rock to pull himself to his feet. He could not stand unassisted, and he had to lean his way around the boulder. He crept forward cautiously, with the grenade ready. The summit was clear. They must be still climbing the cliff. He held his breath and listened with all his being. He heard it again, close at hand, the scrape and slide of cloth against granite, and a sharp, involuntary inhalation of breath. A gasp of effort, as somebody missed and then retrieved a foothold just below the summit. "They are coming up from behind," he told himself, as though explaining to a backward child. Every thought required an effort. 7-second delay on the fuse of the grenade. He stared down at the clumsy weapon that he held by its wooden handle. Too long. They're very close. He lifted the grenade and tried to pull the firing pin. It had corroded and was firmly stuck. He grunted and heaved at it, and the pin came away. He heard the primer click, and he began to count. 1001, 1002, and at the 5th second he stooped and rolled the grenade over the edge. Out of sight, but close by, someone shouted an urgent warning. "Christ, it's a grenade!" And Lothar laughed wildly. "Eat it, you jackals of the English!" He heard them sliding and slipping as they tried to escape, and he braced himself for the explosion. But instead, he heard only the clatter and rattle of the grenade as it bounced and dropped down the slope. Misfire! He stopped laughing. "Oh, damn it to hell!" Then, abruptly but belatedly, the grenade exploded far down the cliff. A crash of sound, followed by the rattle and whine of shrapnel on the rock, and a man cried out. Lothar fell to his knees and crawled to the edge. He looked over. There were 3 khaki-uniformed men on the cliff, sliding and scrambling downwards. He propped the Mauser on the lip and fired rapidly. His bullets left lead smears on the rock close beside the terrified troopers. They dropped the last few feet and started back towards the trees. One of them was hurt, hit by shrapnel. His companions supported him on each side and dragged him away. Lothar lay exhausted by the effort for almost an hour before he could drag himself back to the south side of the summit. He looked down at the dead horses lying in the sun. Already their bellies were swelling, but the water bottles were still strapped to their saddles. "The water is the magnet," he whispered. "By now they will be really thirsty. They will come for the water next." At first, he thought the darkness was only in his mind again. But when he rolled his head and looked into the west, he saw the last orange flash of the sunset in the sky. Before his eyes, it faded. and the sudden African night was upon them. He lay and listened for them to try to reach the water, and he wondered, as he had so often before, at the mystic sounds of the African night. The gentle, muted orchestra of insect and bird, the piping of the hunting bats flitting around the dome of rock, and out on the plain the plaintive yip of jackal, and the occasional outlandish grunting bark of the nocturnal honey badger. Lothar had to try to discount these distractions and listen for man-made sounds in the darkness directly below the cliff. It was only the clink of a stirrup iron that alerted him, and he tossed the grenade with a full swing of his arm out over the abyss. The heavy crump of the explosion blew a puff of air into his face, and by the sudden flare of flame he saw, far below, the dark figures standing over the dead horse. He made out two of them, though he could not be certain there were not others, and he tossed the second grenade. In the brief burst of orange light, he saw them racing back towards the trees. They ran so lightly that they could not have been burdened by water bottles. "Sweat it out," he taunted them. But he had only the one remaining grenade. He held it to his chest as though it was some rare treasure. "Must be ready when they come again. Can't let them get the water." He was talking aloud, and he knew it was a sign of his delirium. Every time he felt the swimming dizziness, he lifted his head and tried to focus on the stars. "Got to hold out," he told himself seriously. "If I can only keep them there till noon tomorrow." He tried to make the calculations of time and distance, but it was too much for him. "Must be 8 hours since Hendrik and Manny left. They will keep going all night. They haven't got me to hold them back. They can make the river before dawn. If only I can hold them another 8 hours, they will get clear away." But the weariness and the fever overwhelmed him, and he cradled his forehead in the curve of his elbow. "Lothar!" It was his imagination, he knew that. But then his name was called again. "Lothar!" And he lifted his head and shivered with the cold of the night and the memories that her voice summoned up. He opened his mouth and then closed it. He would not reply. He would give nothing away. But he listened avidly for Sante and Courtney to call again. "Lothar, we have a wounded man." He judged that she was at the edge of the forest. He could imagine her, determined and brave, that small, firm chin lifted, those dark eyes. "Why do I still love you?" he whispered. "We must have water for him." Strange how clearly her voice carried. He could pick out the inflection of her French accent, and somehow he found that touching. It brought tears to his eyes. "Lothar, I am coming to fetch the water." Her voice was closer, stronger. Clearly she had left the shelter of the trees. "I'm alone, Lothar." She must be halfway across the open ground. "Go back," he tried to shout, but it was a mumble. "I warned you. I have to do it." He fumbled for the grenade. "Can't let you take the water. For Manny's sake, I have to do it." He hooked his finger through the firing ring of the grenade. "I have reached the first horse," she called. "I am taking the bottle. Just one bottle, Lothar." She was in his power. She was standing at the foot of the cliff. It wouldn't need a long throw. All he had to do was roll the grenade over the edge, and it would fly out like a toboggan along the curve of the cliff and land at her feet. He imagined the flash of the explosion, that sweet flesh that had cradled his and harboured his son, torn and rent by razor-edged shrapnel. He thought how much he hated her, and realized that he loved her as much, and the tears in his eyes blinded him. "I'm going back now, Lothar. I have one bottle," she called. And he heard in her voice gratitude and an acknowledgement of the bond between them that no deed, no passage of time could sever. She spoke again, dropping her voice so that it reached him as a faint whisper. "May God forgive you, Lothar de la Rey." And then no more. Those gentle words wounded him as deeply as any he had ever heard from her. There was a finality to them that he found unbearable, and he dropped his head onto his arm to smother the cry of despair which rose in his throat. And the darkness rustled in his head like the wings of a black vulture, as he felt himself falling, falling, falling. "This one is dead," Blaine Malcolmus said quietly, standing over the prostrate figure. They had climbed the cliff at two places in the darkness. Then, in the dawn, they had carried the summit in a concerted rush, only to find it undefended. "Where are the others?" Sergeant Hansmeier hurried out of the shadowy cluster of boulders. "There is no one else on the hill, sir. They must have got away." "Blaine," Santaine called urgently, "where are you? What is happening?" He had insisted that she remain at the foot of the kopje until they had captured the summit. He had not yet signalled to her to come up, but here she was, only a minute behind their attack. "Over here," he snapped, and then, as she ran towards him, "You disobeyed an order, madam." She ignored the accusation. "Where are they?" She broke off as she saw the body. "Oh, God, it's Lothar!" She went down beside him. "So this is de la Rey." "Well, he's dead, I'm afraid," Blaine told her.
"Where are the others?"
Santaine looked up at him anxiously. She had been both dreading and anticipating finding Lothar's bastard. She still tried to avoid using the boy's name even to herself. "Not here," Blaine shook his head. "Given us the slip. De la Rey fooled us and put up a good rearguard delay. They have got clear away. They'll be across the river by now." Manfred. Santaine capitulated and thought of him by name. Manfred, my son. And her disappointment and sense of loss was so strong that it shocked her. She had wanted him to be there, to see him at last. She looked down at his father, and other emotions, long buried and suppressed, rose in her. Lothar lay with his face cradled in the crook of his elbow. The other arm, bound up in strips of stained blanket, was outflung. She touched his neck below the ear, feeling for the carotid artery, and exclaimed immediately she felt the fever heat of his skin. "He's still alive." "Are you sure?" Blaine squatted beside her. Between them, they rolled Lothar onto his back, and they saw the grenade lying under him. "You were right," Blaine said softly. "He did have another grenade. He could have killed you last night." Santaine shivered as she stared down at Lothar's face. He was no longer beautiful and golden and brave. The fever had ruined him. His features had collapsed like those of a corpse, and he was shrunken and grey. "He is badly dehydrated," she said. "Is there water left in that bottle?" While Blaine dribbled water into his mouth, Santaine unwrapped the festering rags from his arm.
blood poisoning.
She recognized the livid lines beneath the skin and the stench of his rotting flesh.
That arm will have to come off.
Though her voice was steady and businesslike, she was appalled at the damage she had wrought. It seemed impossible that a single bite could have caused that. Her teeth were one of her good features, and she was proud of them, always kept them clean and white and cared for. That arm looked as though it had been savaged by one of the carrion eaters, by a hyena or a leopard.
There is a Portuguese Roman Catholic mission at Coanga, on the river, Blaine said, but he'll be lucky if we can get him there alive. With all but one of the horses dead, we'll all be lucky to make it as far as the river ourselves.
He stood up. Sergeant, send one of your men to fetch the first aid kit, and then have the rest of them search every inch of this hilltop. £1 million worth of diamonds are missing. Hansmeier saluted and hurried away, rapping out his orders at his troopers. Blaine sank down beside Santaine. While we're waiting for the medical kit, I suppose we had better search his clothing and equipment in the off chance that he kept any of the stolen diamonds with him.
It's an off chance, all right, Santaine agreed with bitter resignation. The diamonds are almost certainly with his son and that big black Ovambo ruffian of his. And without our bushman trackers, she shrugged.
Blaine spread Lotha's dusty, stained tunic on the rock and began examining the seams, while Santaine bathed Lotha's injured arm and then bound it up with clean white bandages from the medical kit.
Nothing, sir, Hansmeier reported back. We've gone over every inch of this rock, every nook and cranny.
Very well, Sergeant. Now we have to get this beggar off the kopje without letting him fall and break his neck.
Not that he doesn't deserve it, said the sergeant.
Blaine grinned.
He does deserve it. But we don't want to do the hangman out of his 5 guineas, do we now, Sergeant?
They were ready to move out within the hour. Lotha de la Rey was strapped into a drag litter of Mopani saplings behind their single remaining horse, and the wounded trooper, the grenade shrapnel still in his back and shoulder, rode up in Santaine's saddle. Santaine lingered at the foot of the kopje after the column had started northwards towards the river once more, and Blaine came back to stand beside her. He took her hand, and she sighed and leaned lightly against his shoulder. Oh, Blaine, for me, so much has ended here in this godforsaken wilderness, on this sun-blasted lump of rock.
I think I can understand how much the loss of the diamonds means.
Do you, Blaine?
I don't think so. I don't think even I can take it in yet. Everything has changed. Even my hatred for Lotha.
There is still a chance we will recover the stones.
No, Blaine. You and I both know there is no chance. The diamonds are gone.
He did not attempt to deny it, did not offer false comfort.
I have lost it all. Everything I ever worked for me and my son, it's all gone.